For investors right now, it's getting hard to pick up the newspaper and read the headlines without getting heartburn. Russia's saber-rattling towards Ukraine could be on the verge of turning from posturing into something very dangerous and very real. Inflation has hit a point that more than half of all Americans have never seen before. Congress seems stuck in neutral, unable to find a path forward on just about any issue of consequence. And the Federal Reserve is poised to bring its monetary policy power to bear in an environment in which economic data is more muddled than at any time in recent memory. For investors who have weathered a very rough start to 2022, it's a test of nerves. Welcome to Washington Wise, a podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. I'm your host, Mike Townsend, and on this show, our goal is to cut through the noise and confusion of the nation's capital and help investors figure out what's really worth paying attention to. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll be chatting with TD Ameritrade's chief market strategist, J.J. Kinahan, about what's going on in these complicated markets, the outsized role that a handful of the largest stocks are playing in the markets, and ideas for investors on how to approach these volatile times. But first, let's take a look at some of the issues grabbing the headlines here in Washington. Today, I'll share updates on three issues we've been following. On Capitol Hill, angst is continuing to grow about the economy, especially after last week's news that inflation in January rose another 0.6% and hit 7.5% on an annual basis, the highest level since 1982. Democrats are scrambling to figure out whether there is a policy response that can get inflation under control before voters go to the polls in November for a midterm election that is increasingly looking like a referendum on inflation. For Democrats who control the White House and have majorities, very slim majorities, but still majorities, in both the House and the Senate, they know that much of the blame for the economic situation will fall on them. But Democrats in Congress are struggling to find a unified path forward. Some want to focus on a revised version of the Build Back Better Act, but others think that increasing federal spending is exactly the opposite of what should be done. Last week, the White House acknowledged that it was looking at repackaging the failed Build Back Better Act into a bill that has a bigger focus on deficit reduction. That's been a key issue for Senator Joe Manchin, the moderate Democrat from West Virginia, whose opposition to the $2 trillion spending package torpedoed that plan in December. Manchin has signaled that he would be open to pairing some climate-related initiatives with tax increases on wealthy filers and corporations that would help get the deficit under control. Plans are very much still in their infancy, but this is something to keep an eye on over the next few weeks, as it potentially puts some of the tax increases that were discussed last year, things like increasing the top individual tax rate or creating a new surtax for the wealthiest individuals, back in the mix. There are other ideas floating around as well. Several Democratic senators last week proposed suspending the gas tax for the rest of the year as a way to put more money back in people's pockets. Others want to focus on cutting health care costs, particularly by lowering the cost of prescription drugs. Look for these discussions to continue over the next few weeks as Democrats try to find a fiscal policy response to complement that expected monetary policy response from the Federal Reserve in the effort to get inflation under control before the fall campaign season kicks into high gear. Speaking of the Fed, I've also been watching the drive to fill the various vacancies at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors at a time when the Fed is poised to raise interest rates at its meeting next month. Here's the latest. Earlier this week, the Senate Banking Committee planned to meet to take a series of confirmation votes on the president's nominees for the Fed. Those committee votes are the last step before the nominations get a final vote by the full Senate. However, there was an unexpected kerfuffle. The Republicans on the committee refused to show up for the meeting, which meant a quorum was not present, and the committee could not vote on any of the nominees. The bulk of the drama has centered on the nomination of Sarah Bloom Raskin, President Biden's choice to be the next vice chair of supervision, a position that is responsible for the oversight of the nation's largest banks. But her nomination is opposed by all the Republicans on the committee, who think Raskin will pull the central bank's focus away from monetary policy and towards politically motivated positions on issues like bank regulation, climate change, and income inequality. They also want more information on Raskin's role as a member of the board of directors of a financial technology company in 2017. That company was given access to the Fed's reserve payment system after Raskin, a former Fed governor from 2010 to 2014, made calls to key Fed officials. Republicans want to know more about whether Raskin used her connections at the Fed to get favorable treatment for the company. The lack of a quorum at the meeting meant that the committee could not vote on the other four Fed nominees, all of whom are likely to receive varying degrees of bipartisan support. That includes Jerome Powell and his nomination for a second four-year term as chair. Powell's term actually ended earlier this month, so he's officially known now as the chair pro tempore, which is essentially the acting chair. The committee will also need to reconvene to vote on the nominations of Lael Brainard, a current Fed governor, to be elevated to vice chair, and economists Lisa Cook and Philip Jefferson to the other two open seats. Cook would be the first black woman ever to sit on the seven-member Fed Board of Governors, while Jefferson would be just the fourth black man. As I record this podcast, it's unclear how and when the standoff will be resolved, but I don't expect the holdup, at least for Powell, Brainard, Cook, and Jefferson, to last too long. With the Senate on recess for the week of President's Day, final confirmation votes could come as soon as the week of February 28th. The goal continues to be to get as many of these nominees confirmed as possible before that mid-March meeting, at which the Fed will consider raising interest rates and taking other steps to address rising inflation. Finally, this week provided us with yet another deadline for a potential government shutdown. But Congress is set to buy itself more time by extending that deadline for another 3 weeks. Congress still has not passed any of the 12 appropriations bills that fund every federal agency and every federal program for this fiscal year, which began back on October 1st. In order to avoid a government shutdown, back in late September, lawmakers agreed to a temporary extension, known as a continuing resolution. That is just an agreement to keep funding the government at last year's rate for a specific period of time, and then to use that time to pass the appropriations bills. Well, that first continuing resolution went until early December, and then a second extension lasts until February 18th. Last week, the House approved another extension, this time to March 11th. The Senate is poised to pass the extension by the end of the week. Some progress has been made toward a longer-term agreement. Last week, the four leaders of the appropriations process, representing the two parties and the two chambers, agreed on the top-line number, the total amount to be spent on defense and domestic programs. Now, the appropriators need to divvy that money up among every program. The goal is to finish that process before the new March 11th deadline, and we'll see whether that happens. On today's Deeper Dive, I want to focus on why the markets have become so volatile in recent weeks, ways investors can approach that volatility, and how a handful of the large tech companies have become so influential in the markets. To help me sort through all that, I'm pleased to welcome J.J. Kinahan, Chief Market Strategist at TD Ameritrade, where he looks at the market from an active trader's perspective. TD Ameritrade was acquired by Schwab in 2020, and the two companies are currently in the process of integrating. J.J., welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Mike. Appreciate being here.
I want to begin by just getting your take on the markets, which have been quite bumpy since the beginning of 2022. But the various segments in the markets haven't been bumpy in the same way or to the same degree. And just looking at the numbers for the key indices really tells that story. As of the start of this week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 6% year-to-date, and the S&P 500 is down about 8%. But the Russell 2000 is down more than 10%, and the NASDAQ Composite is down nearly 13%. So what's your take on what's going on here?
Well, if you look at what's going on in the environment overall, I think there's one word that's sort of reigning over all else, and that's volatility. And why do I say that? Because we've had not only the Russia-Ukraine situation to start the year, which hopefully will be drawn down with diplomacy, but the big overlying gorilla in the room continues to be the Fed. And what is the Fed going to do? To be honest, Mike, in my career, I've never seen volatility in the numbers of a rate hike or a rate cut that the Fed may have as much as I've seen in the last few weeks. So with that, what does that lead to? That leads to uncertainty everywhere in the market, and we're seeing that. What do many investors do when we have uncertainty in the market? They turn to stocks that they believe they can trust. In other words, those stocks that have earnings, that have cash. that can withstand some tougher times. The blue chips, what indices have more of those than others? Dow Jones and S&P 500. So it's not really, from that point of view, not particularly surprising to see them outperforming the NASDAQ. You know, how many times do you hear the term tech-heavy NASDAQ when you hear it even being described? And some of the technology companies, although their stocks may have done well over the past year, they don't necessarily have earnings. And so, you know, positive earnings, positive cash flow is incredibly important when things are a little bit more uncertain. And so when I look at the market from that point of view, and you think about what's happened over the last couple of years with a low interest rate environment, great growth, as we head to a little bit more of an uncertain time, particularly before this Fed meeting of March 14th and 15th, not necessarily a big surprise to see many investors turn to a more blue chip type stock, which, as I said, is contained more in the Dow Jones and S&P 500 indices.
Well, JJ, in this kind of environment, are there potential opportunities if I'm more of a buy and hold investor rather than a trader? What if I want to focus just on protecting my portfolio because I'm getting really worried about how this year is shaping up?
One of the things I love about the market, and I love a lot about it, I hope you can tell whenever you talk to me about the market, is that it doesn't matter what kind of investor you are. Be it a trader, be it a longer-term investor, there's always some potential opportunities for you. Now, it may swing a little bit more towards traders in certain times. It may swing a little bit more towards longer-term investors at times. But you wake up every day and there's some potential opportunity. It's a matter of being disciplined and taking advantage of it. Now, let's talk about a longer-term investor in this market. I think in all markets as a longer-term investor, the first thing you need to do if you haven't already is have a plan. What are the holding times I want for the product that I am buying? And I'm saying product because I don't care if it's an ETF, it's a mutual fund, if it's a security, whatever it is, they are all products. So what products fit into your portfolio overall? What is the holding time you have for those products when you buy them? And more importantly, do you feel that those are products that during these times, particularly when there's a bit more uncertainty, when volatility seems to be ruling the day, if you will, do you feel they can withstand some of that volatility? And that's a really important point to make, particularly on longer-term investments. Markets go up and down. Do you feel confident that the products you have can withstand these downfalls and still come out good on the other side? The other thing is, I started with have a plan. Number two, stick to the plan. We can probably both cite time after time when people had a plan, things got a little bit rocky, and they immediately got out rather than sticking with it, or at least sticking with most of it. If you want to unload a little bit of it, understood, because you can't take the pressure, but don't be all in or all out on something like that. If you have a plan, over time, it really plays out to stick with that plan.
Well, JJ, let's talk more specifically about some of those big internet companies that are in the NASDAQ and other indices. Earlier this month, companies like Meta, the parent of Facebook, and Spotify reported disappointing earnings that all by themselves really sent the broader markets into a tailspin. And then companies like Amazon and Alphabet, the parent of Google, reported great earnings, and the broader markets responded positively. And we know this is not just a one-off trend. Last year, just 7 companies were responsible for 33% of the S&P 500's entire return for the year. So does it worry you that such a small number of companies have such an outsized impact on the market?
Well, in the shorter term, I would say yes. It's probably not the greatest thing in the world that so few companies have such a great influence. But you and I have both been around long enough to know that these trends happen at times and then it spreads out again. And I would expect it to do that same thing in this time. So you're naming those stocks right now. You think about the FANG stocks have sort of had their way for a little while. Before that, it was the BRIC stocks. There's always the sort of in favor group that everybody has to own, et cetera. That all being said, what worries me more actually is that those are stocks that make up a lot of funds or ETFs, et cetera. And so with that, those being drawn down also sometimes hurt people's confidence. And we talked about Meta. Meta particularly is one that's widely held by many funds, as I said, many ETFs, and many individual traders or investors have that in their portfolio, which can affect their confidence. Now, that all being said, as we go forward, did you ever think that stocks like that would be trading like meme stocks? Because that's exactly what they did over that week. You needed a neck brace because things were moving around so quickly. So, again, this goes back to having a plan. And what I really think people have to plan for is continued volatility. I'm going to continue to hammer that point a little bit throughout this podcast, Mike, because I really feel, particularly until we have that first Fed meeting here on March 14th and 15th, that volatility is going to be a little bit of the name of the game.
Let me follow up on one of the things you mentioned, which is that a lot of people own stocks of this handful of companies. But probably even more people hold mutual funds and exchange-traded funds that these stocks likely make up a significant amount of those funds' holdings. So if investors aren't paying attention to what's in the funds they hold, there may be quite a bit of duplication, and their exposure could be greater than they realize. So how should investors deal with this?
Well, I think the first thing starts with a little bit of homework, and I know everybody hears the word homework, and they think back to their high school days, and they're like, no way. But that being said, I think you really do yourself a favor as an investor if you look at the funds or ETFs you hold and you say, okay, what are the top 10 holdings of those funds? I'm just going to use an example, not a recommendation, on a couple of stocks just because they're so widely held by funds and ETFs, and that being Apple and Microsoft. If you're somebody who personally may own those stocks, you have a fund that has those stocks as a heavy weighting. You have a ETF that has those stocks as a heavy weighting. You may want to look at yourself and say, am I overweighted in these two stocks? If they go down, is my risk oversized because of the way I'm exposed to those two stocks in particular? Then you have to look and say, okay, should I make a choice to lighten up so I don't have an oversized risk to two stocks? And I think people forget to take into account their mutual funds and ETFs on that. The example I always use is there was a particular ETF around home builders that a few years ago, the number one stock in that was Whirlpool. I'm not saying that's good or bad, but if you were invested in that, you know, Whirlpool makes a lot of appliances, I get it. But if you were invested in that and you didn't realize that Whirlpool had the number one weighting, you're making a big mistake. You don't understand. You just looked at the name of the product. You didn't look at what makes up the product, and I think that that's a mistake people make sometimes. If you're going into something, please understand the factors that are going to influence whether you have good days, have bad days, and most importantly, every investment should start with one word, and that is risk. What is the risk you are exposing yourself to on a product?
JJ, this is a podcast, as you know, that tries to draw connections between Washington and the markets. And, you know, these companies that we're talking about have a lot to worry about: supply chain shortages, retaining workers, rising costs. But I think we can add to that regulation and policies coming out of Washington. Washington has really struggled to find a consensus on how and how much to regulate these companies. But I think there are threats coming at them from multiple angles right now. Congress is considering antitrust legislation that could force significant changes to how companies like Google and Amazon and Apple act, could even force these companies to spin off some of their businesses. Regulators are looking at a host of issues ranging from anti-competitive behavior, election interference, content management, free speech issues, protecting children online, and a whole list of issues. So how real is the threat to their bottom line from this focus on regulation and legislation? And as we were just talking about, if most of us have exposure to these companies, either directly or through funds and exchange-traded funds, should we be concerned?
Well, you know better than I, Mike. In D.C., there's sometimes political bellowing, if you will, as compared to actual practical change. So I think one of the things you have to sort of decide is, which one of these is this? Now, the stocks that you're referring to, let's face it, they've been up on Capitol Hill a couple of times over the last couple of years. They have had to testify in front of different congressional committees. So that tells me this is a little bit more serious of a risk. One of the things that you have to decide when you're investing is, okay, again, if you start with risk, what are the risks to this stock or this investment going down? And so in this case, you would have to take regulatory risk as one of those you want to assign a probability to. At the moment, maybe you think it's a little bit lower. But if those companies get called up in front of the congressional committees again, you have to start assigning a higher probability to that risk. It's something you should be considering, though. These types of regulatory changes, and again, Mike, you're there every day, you know better than I, they take a while. And most importantly, I think they're usually telegraphed. It's not like a government agency one day wakes up and all of a sudden they're like, this company, we're doing a bunch of different things to it, unless there's some really bad things going on there where it's some sort of fraudulent activity or something like that. But putting the really bad actors aside, for most good, solid companies in the United States, which are major players in these indices, if anything is going to come from a regulatory point of view from Congress, et cetera, you're going to have some sort of telegraph, as I said beforehand, but you should be paying attention when the members of Congress start talking about these companies, because that's your first clue. Then you have to watch what's the follow through. But I don't think it's the goal of anybody to bring these companies to their knees either. People recognize the fact that these companies employ a lot of people. They're an important part of our economy. There's always room for some regulation. Again, this is all about your own personal risk assignment to this company and the amount that you think it can hurt the stock price longer term.
Really important point that you made there, JJ, is the time factor. I think I tell investors all the time that regulation, the process is really, really slow in Washington. And you're absolutely right that you know it's coming from miles away, because there's a whole process in which regulations are proposed, and there's a public comment period, and there's various consideration. And then often things don't even take effect until, you know, a year after they're finalized. So something very much to keep in mind. I do agree with you that I think the trend is towards more scrutiny of these companies, not less. But in terms of actual action, I think we'll have plenty of notice. Let me ask you about one of the other trends that has shaped the markets over the last year or so, and that's the rise of retail traders, probably embodied best by the whole meme stock frenzy that sent the stock of companies like GameStop and AMC Entertainment Holdings, the movie theater chain, on these wild rides during the pandemic. But over the last couple of years, the number of retail traders has really boomed, I think in part because so many people were stuck at home. Many of these new traders got caught up in the day trading frenzy around certain stocks that they read about on social media. And social media has become a really important part of people's consideration of what stocks to invest in. I think that frantic trading pace has cooled a bit, but does the sheer number of new retail traders represent kind of a sea change in the degree of influence that ordinary investors are going to have on the market?
I absolutely believe it has. I think the retail trader has never gotten more respect. The greatest thing about the meme stock craze is it brought new investors and new interest in the market. So why is this such a positive? Because we also saw educational usage increase significantly, and in a correlation to the new people coming to the market. That's fantastic news. How many people for the first time, Mike, came up to you, a younger person, high school or college age, and asked you a question about the market? They never did that as much before. Now you saw people having interest. Many people for the first time, and I'm not even talking about investing or trading in the market necessarily here. Many people for the first time looked at their 401k and maybe took the time to actually understand what's in it. So, yes, the meme stock craze was, in my opinion, an overall big positive. Now, the second half of your question is, how is that changing going forward? I actually think the big change primarily is going to be on how people garner their information. As we know, one of the places that meme stock started was on a chat board. It showed that people are getting their information from different places. It's just not necessarily CNBC, the Wall Street Journal, or Forbes anymore. There's a lot of micro sites and other sites. So I think that's going to be the biggest change going forward, is what kind of sites are people going to, and is the information they're getting 100% accurate?
Well, no question, JJ, that this is a place where regulators are getting involved. And I think this is something that's probably of interest to all investors, no matter how frequently you trade. The SEC released a study last fall on the meme stock frenzy, and while the report said that the markets worked well for the most part, they are moving forward with some regulatory proposals to address some of the issues that came up. Last week, in fact, the SEC proposed a rule that would require the entire industry to speed up the settlement time for stock trades. Currently, trades settle 2 days after the day the trade was executed, and the rule proposal would shorten that to 1 day by 2024. How big a deal is that for investors?
Well, for investors, what it does, I think, is it puts the securities industry in a more modern way to keep up with other industries. Mike, when you and I were young, you'd deposit a check, it might take 3-4 days to clear before you could use the money. Now it's pretty much instantaneous, or at least same day or next day. This is the same thing that we're trying to be brought to the securities industry. Right now, it takes 2 days basically to settle a stock. They're trying to make it a one-day settlement to stock. And again, this is sort of just keeps up with what's going on elsewhere. Hopefully, most investors don't notice it except in a positive way, in that they have access to their money faster than they did before.
Well, JJ, this has been a great conversation. So let me end with this. What's your outlook for the rest of 2022? There seems to be so much impact in the markets right now. We have persistent supply chain issues, got the weird jobs market, inflation right now higher, of course, than most investors have ever seen in their lifetime. The Fed rate hikes that we talked about that are expected to begin next month. So what's your advice to investors who are struggling to sort through it all?
Yeah, you know, Mike, where we started this was the word volatility. And I would say that investors have to keep that in mind, particularly for the rest of this first quarter as we head into this Fed meeting on March 14th and 15th. There's so much unknown about how many times rates will be raised this year. As I said, you know, we see the CME Fed Watch tool telling us that it looks to be about 5.5 times. That all said, we have volatility within that number, from some firms saying 4 to some firms coming out and saying 7. So we'll see what that comes out to be. But it shows you the uncertainty. That number is usually not a volatile number by any stretch of the imagination, of how many Fed rate hikes or Fed rate cuts there may be in a year, which tells you be prepared for volatility. Number two, review the portfolio. Are these products that you do want to hold on to, and do you have a set time for them that you want to hold on to them for? And number three, if you are changing some things around in your portfolio, do something in a very measured fashion. You shouldn't be all out or all in at one time. People say don't have emotion in trading. I'm sorry, it's money. You're going to have some emotion around it. And so with that, though, you want to make things as mechanical as possible. And too often, the I got to get out of everything right now is a really bad decision. If you do need to lighten up because you're not feeling comfortable, you're not sleeping, that makes sense. But maybe you start with a percentage of the portfolio rather than the whole thing. And same thing on getting in. Start with a smaller percentage. You'll have time to do it. So those are really my primary pieces of advice in all markets, but particularly in one that's a bit more volatile.
Well, that's terrific advice, JJ. You've really given us some great perspective on a market that I think is making a lot of investors pretty anxious right now. Thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Mike, thanks for having me a guest. It was a lot of fun.
That's JJ Kinahan, Chief Market Strategist at TD Ameritrade. You can follow him on Twitter at TDAJJKinahan. Finally, on my Why It Matters segment, I'd like to note something interesting that's happening in Washington that may have been below the radar screen and explain why I think it's important. Today, just a quick update on something I discussed a couple episodes back. Momentum seems to be really growing on Capitol Hill toward banning stock trading for elected officials. But as with everything in Washington, it's complicated. There are now multiple bills to ban trading by members of Congress to various degrees. And last week, the leaders of both the House and the Senate spoke publicly about their support for those efforts. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York, speaking on the Senate floor, urged Democrats and Republicans to work together to craft a workable proposal for a stock ownership ban. More significant were the comments of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has been opposed to such a ban. In the face of strong support by rank-and-file House Democrats, she moved from opposition to what I'd characterize as lukewarm support for the effort. But she added a new wrinkle by calling for any rules to apply also to federal judges. A recent investigation by the Wall Street Journal found hundreds of examples of federal judges who owned or traded stock in companies over whose court cases they were presiding. At least one of the proposals on the table would extend the stock trading ban to the federal judiciary, as well as to the Federal Reserve, which has itself been the center of a trading scandal in recent months. But some members of Congress are pointing out that while it's an easy message to be for a stock trading ban, putting actual rules in place is turning out to be much more complicated. There are lots of unanswered questions. Should a trading ban or restrictions apply to the official spouse? What about children, siblings, other family relations? How would the activities of a family member be tracked? Should all investments be put in a blind trust? If elected officials are forced to sell before taking office, can they defer capital gains taxes? What about cryptocurrency or real estate investments or businesses owned by an elected official or a family member? These are just some of the many questions that still need to be hashed out. And there's growing concern that some of these questions may be nearly impossible to resolve, potentially stalling the effort entirely. This is going to be an interesting one to watch. The Fed, Congress, and the federal judiciary have all been rocked by trading scandals in the last year or two. There's widespread bipartisan support for the general idea of cracking down on or eliminating stock trading entirely for these groups. But can something be crafted that is both broad enough and narrow enough to win bipartisan votes? We'll see. Well, that's all for this week's episode of Washington Wise. We'll be back with a new episode in 2 weeks, so please take a moment now to follow the show in your listening app so you don't miss an episode. And if you like what you've heard, leave us a rating or a review. That really helps new listeners discover the show. For important disclosures, see the show notes or schwab.com/WashingtonWise, where you can also find a transcript. I'm Mike Townsend, and this has been Washington Wise, a podcast for investors. Wherever you are, stay safe, stay healthy, and keep investing wisely.